This is Ecoverse, a podcast dedicated to bring you stories about climate action happening around the world. Our podcast is designed to inspire, motivate, and challenge us. We'll hear stories about ordinary people who are doing extraordinary things to help our planet. Tune in to hear interviews with experts and people who are working to take a stand against climate change. The Ecoverse podcast is produced by Creative Studio Productions, whose mission is to amplify the good around the world. I remember my parents driving me through Mount St. Helens National Park on a family trip back in the early 1990s, when I was only around 8 or 9 years old. I was taken back by the devastation that the eruption of May 18, 1980 had caused on the entire landscape. What was once huge trees now just littered the hillside. They looked like scattered toothpicks laying down on all the hills leading to the volcano. They were facing in the way that the blast had pushed them over on that fateful day in May 1980. I wasn't even born yet at the time of the blast, but even a decade later, the evidence of the blast was still around. Trees had fallen at the end of the blast zone, and trees were scorched, black, and lifeless. Not a shred of an evergreen needle or a leaf could be seen. And yet, it seemed there was something holy about this place. Not because of the death or devastation of the volcano, but because of the memory of what it once had been. Pictures were on signs along the drive, and a visitor center showed photos of a before and after photo of the blast. While in the visitor center, we learned the eruption produced a force equal to 10 to 50 megatons of TNT. That's about the equivalent of 25,000 atomic bombs released over the city of Hiroshima during World War II. And the superheated gas and rock exploded out of the volcano sideways at speeds of up to 400 miles an hour. The eruption, which had a volcanic explosivity index of 5, was the most significant to occur in the United States. It has often been declared the most disastrous volcanic eruption in U.S. history. Now, I know we're not facing the same type of disaster in the West, but we are facing something that nonetheless scorches the forests and burns some of America's oldest trees. In fact, some climate scientists are saying that it is the end of the old growth forests. The beautiful larger-than-life sequoia trees are facing extinction. With the mega drought, wildfires have become more and more of an issue. So what can we do? How can we make a difference? How can we do what we can and care? Today, I'm joined by my guest, Ian C. Williams. Ian is an educator, speaker, and business advisor. Through mindfulness, systems thinking, and regenerative design, he empowers the growth and development of individuals and communities. As a business advisor, he fosters healthy organizational cultures through processes of optimization, wellness integration, and environmental restoration. He dedicates himself to humanitarian and environmental endeavors to generate systematic change for the common good. Ian is an author, and he's just released his new book called Soil and Spirit. So, Ian, thanks for being here. Can you tell us a little bit about your new book, since you're author, speaker, educator? Yeah, just give us a little synopsis about your book.
Yeah, the title is Soil and Spirit. Subtitle is Seeds of Purpose, Nature's Insight, and the Deep Work of Transformational Change.
Wow.
The book is really a commentary on the relationship between internal, personal, and spiritual cultivation and cultural transformation. It's not a prescriptive, didactic, dogmatic book about, you know, 10 steps to a new you, or here's what we need to do in order to, you know, address things like climate change or social injustice. It's more of a opportunity to journey inward and to recognize how the way that we live our lives as individuals impacts the world around us.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Ian, for being here. Appreciate you.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Could you share a little bit of your background with us and our listeners?
Yeah, academically, I got my BA in psychology and community arts. It was a double major at Concordia University, St. Paul. And then my master's is in public affairs from the University of Minnesota, with a self-designed emphasis in leadership strategy and organizational culture.
I remember you and I kind of just sitting down over coffee a few months back, and we were talking about your new book, but also you had just gotten back from this awesome road trip that you took out west. I think I was asking you a lot about climate and kind of what you were seeing out there, and not trying to sound crazy, I had to ask about what you thought would happen to the Southwest, as I thought we might see it become a desert. And you, to my surprise, agreed with me. It made me feel like I wasn't the only crazy person around. But you described to me what you saw when you drove out there. Could you maybe just share a little bit of the story and kind of what you saw as it pertains to climate change?
Yeah. I mean, to your first point about the Southwest and kind of where we originally started that conversation over coffee, you know, I mean, there's a term for it, desertification, right? Turning landscapes into deserts. Mm. Humans are really good at it. And so maybe we'll circle back to that later. But in terms of what I saw, you know, I spent about 2 weeks mostly through California, West Coast, visited Joshua Tree, Sequoia National, made our way up to the Redwoods, you know, and I've had family out there. And so I've been in touch with them off and on over the years. And, you know, what we saw, I think the thing that stood out to me the most was driving through Sequoia National, you know, with the fires that happened in 2021, the three of them that converged.
Yeah.
I mean, you can be driving on the main park road for 5-10 minutes and not see a tree that's alive.
Wow.
And, you know, I've never been to Sequoia. It's been atop my list in terms of national parks for at least a decade now. So going there and, I mean, it was still a truly magical and majestic place, but recognizing that destruction that had happened, you know, was, I guess the word I would use is sobering.
Yeah.
But again, having family out there and having conversations with them and, you know, noticing how you just have wildfire season.
Yeah.
Right. Which is kind of a terrifying thing. It's like we have winter here in Minnesota. They have wildfire season.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's how dry California is, right? Yeah. And it's not just, we're not just talking about a year or 3 years here. We're talking about climate changing,
right?
And so I guess back to that point about desertification, it's already happening.
Yeah. So, you know, I've heard climate change kind of, you know, described a little bit as kind of like a slow train wreck. Right? Like it's obviously you're seeing the burnt trees and you're seeing the desertification of California, but at the same time, it's like the rest of the nation or parts of the other parts of the nation aren't quite waking up to that reality yet, you know? And so it's almost like there's a disconnect between this kind of slow warming and the effects that it's going to have in the future. And the immediate now, you know, I think immediately we just want to try to, you know, mitigate what we can. But the question is there anything that we can do to mitigate long-term climate change?
Yeah, I think there definitely is. It's a reason why I'm not a huge fan of the term sustainability, because if we sustain the course that we're on right now, the science says we're still not on a good course.
Okay.
Right. I mean, the thing that I think about is kind of like we've got civilization and this human species, which is careening towards a cliff. And sustainability to me just means applying the brakes, right? We're gonna sustain what we're currently doing, so we're just gonna slow down the rate at which we get there. We need to turn the wheel. We need a different direction to go.
Right.
Right. Or rather, we simply need to embrace an awareness that encourages us to think about our relationship to the natural world in a different way. And I want to be really clear here that when I, you know, if I use the term our awareness, I'm referring specifically to Western society. I mean, there are indigenous cultures worldwide and have been for millennia that are still very much in tune with the natural rhythms of the earth, you know? And so we need to just be cognizant about not throwing a blanket over this whole conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and so to your points about we're kind of seeing this slow warming, you know, the climate data identified climate change back in the 70s, I believe. And so we have been, I guess you could say, seeing a slow warming since then. But the projections in the models have also always included a, you know, we're going to reach this kind of tipping point where climate is going to become more volatile. And I think that's what we're really starting to see now in the last decade.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing increased tropical storms and increased wildfires and increased just intense weather events, right? I mean, having lived here in Minnesota my whole life, winters definitely look different than they did when I was a kid just 20, 30 years ago, right? So we're seeing the shift, and it's this really amplification of intensity. And that's something that I think is really going to be a linchpin to now more specifically addressing your question of what can we do about it. It's really a conversation about awareness, right? And so one of my favorite sayings about science is, I don't remember who said it, but they said that's the beautiful thing about science is whether you believe it or not, it's still true. You know, we need to open up space. And again, collectively, we, speaking more specifically here in the West, where we can talk about these things in a more conversational way, like you and I are doing right now, because the divisiveness is certainly not helping us when it comes to really creating solutions at scale.
Right.
Right. We're seeing this in politics. We're seeing this in business. We're seeing this in society in general. And that divisiveness is really crippling from a, you know, creating effective transformational change. But the reality is we just need to be able to start having the conversation. We need, we need to be able to sit down at the table, make sure everybody's got a seat at that table. And I mean, everybody, and you know, embrace the wisdom of indigenous cultures as well as embrace the innovation that has come out of Western culture and find a way to kind of bridge the gap, you know, or marry those two things together, because I feel like we're going to need both.
Yeah. I want to go back to what you said about kind of the awareness piece and the Western culture awareness piece, because they're, you know, from a traditional standpoint, in the Hebrew tradition, in the Christianity tradition, in the Islam tradition, even in, you know, I think China and kind of their animism traditions, they really kind of have this connection to the environment. Deep within the Christian tradition, it was tied to Abraham, and same with Islam and Judaism. And then you have, you know, the animism in China, where they build these temples and they actually face the fields because they want their ancestors to kind of bless. So there's this spiritual component to that was tied to the land. There was a caring for the environment. There was kind of this overall arching sense, well, if your crops didn't do well, then God or your ancestors weren't blessing you. But also there was a respect for the environment and kind of the food production and what was going on. How have we lost that in Western culture? I mean, I completely agree with you that we do not have the same relationship with the land that our ancestors maybe had a long time ago. And even you brought up the indigenous people and their relationship with the land. Where did we lose that relationship with the land and the environment?
It's an interesting question. And, you know, I think to bring my humility into this conversation, I can't say for sure, you know, I don't know. There's a word or a phrase that I use in my teachings and writings, which is eco-reverence. And it's a word, you know, that
I love that.
I think we need to revive a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. There's got to be a reverence for the natural world, but then it leads to a, conversation about epistemology and why do we need to revive it, and how did we, to your point, drift away from it? But I do think back to the time of the Industrial Revolution, right? And we started to mechanize many different aspects of life. And if you think about the paradigms of capitalism and consumerism, they're really based off of a fundamental assumption, which is infinite growth.
Mm.
Creating more money, creating more goods to consume. And I think that we're just at a point right now in the evolution of our civilization where we're recognizing that that paradigm of infinite growth is mutually exclusive and at odds with the natural world.
Right.
Right. We live on a finite planet,
mm-hmm.
specifically finite in the way that we choose to relate with her, you know, extracting natural resources. Even the term natural resources fundamentally defines the natural world as a reservoir to deplete, to take from.
Mm.
Right.
That's good.
They're resources. We can take them and we can use them to our own benefit. And this notion that we are separate from it is really at the crux of it all, right? Humans living on this planet. No, we're humans living in this planet.
Mm.
We are a part of her natural rhythms. We are a part of these ecosystems. We're having a pretty high level kind of pie in the sky conversation around these things. But if you, you know, if you want to take like a specific example, one that I think about often is the plow. Decades ago when it was invented, it was revolutionary in terms of creating more output from an agricultural perspective. Now we're seeing that there's so much intricacy in that soil biology and soil health. And, you know, tilling every year, plowing every year deconstructs that, you know, that soil biology.
Yep.
Right? The mycorrhizae and the fungi and all the microbes. And so then we start to see the impact of those actions.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, you know, in the regenerative agriculture movement, there's this awareness now.
Yep.
And beyond the regenerative agriculture movement as well. But, you know, it's this notion of interconnectedness.
Right.
And so to go back to that, your question and this notion of eco-reverence, right? I mean, I think what we need to do, it starts with the foundation is simply acknowledging, accepting, embracing again that we are a part of this web. We are not separate from it in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's step one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really good. I like the example of the plow. My wife and I are helping out at our family orchard, and we've decided to ditch the plow, if you will, to do this regenerative farming. I'll let you know how it goes. You know, it's so funny because it's something you don't, you know, you've been taught this way. This is how you do it. And so it's just ingrained in you. And so this is how we do it. There's nothing wrong with, you don't think there's anything wrong with the way that you're doing it until you see that you're taking away from the soil. You know, there's so many times where we might have to add fertilizer or add something to the soil, but if we would just care for our soil, we wouldn't necessarily need to do those things. You know, there's things like cover crops that a lot of people are doing, the rye and things like that. And instead of burning it off, they're crimping it down to kind of regenerate the soil underneath. You know, and I heard somebody say, we were at a sustainability conference, my wife and I, this last weekend, and I heard somebody say there should never be a time where your field is empty. There should never be. And I just think, I thought about that. And I just thought about how many times do I go on a drive in the winter or in the fall time and the fields are just completely bare, you know? And that's one of the reasons why we had the Dust Bowl and those types of things is because we didn't care for the soil that we have. So I loved that illustration that you gave with the plow.
Yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of one of my ever-present existential crises driving around the Midwest. You know, I mean, you're absolutely right. If you look into natural ecosystems, which they're becoming, you know, increasingly less and less, you don't see bare soil.
Right.
It's not something that Mother Earth produces. I think it was the World Food Organization. Predictions are by 2045, we will have a global population that is north of 9 billion.
Wow.
And we will be producing 40% less food.
Oh my.
Because of soil health and soil destruction.
Yeah. Thank you for that. But, yeah. You know, I'm, you know, coming at it from a perspective of where we're sitting today. You know, I think that in some ways, we're going to see food securities, yes, worsen around the world, especially for third world or, you know, less countries that have resources to grow those foods. But we're also going to see it, I think, in the United States specifically.
Mm-hmm.
When we start to see some of those, like you said, California, even parts of Nevada, and, you know, just all going dry. You know, Nebraska could eventually go dry. And these are states that produce a lot of food for the United States. And so I think in the regards of the United States, I think we're going to see food securities, you know, for, we're going to feel it is what I'm saying as well. Yeah,
especially people as privileged as you and I need to be extremely cognizant of and conscious of the way that we choose to respond, mm-hmm. because we're already, again, we're already seeing these things. You know, like the most recent one that's happening now is eggs, right?
Yeah.
You know, the cost of eggs,
yes.
You know? And if you dive into the food bill, and if you dive into North America's food system, the US's food system, it is not a free market.
Right.
It is heavily subsidized by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reality is, if it were more of a free market, all of these things would be exacerbated because even more costs would be being passed on to us as consumers.
Yeah.
And where I kind of come to rest on your point is we don't need to awaken the masses. We don't need everyone to understand this. We just need to reach critical mass.
Mm.
We need enough people to, you know, whatever the new age term is right now, wake up and experience, see reality for what it is.
Yeah.
And experience what that feels like internally, right? How does that feel? Is there discord and discontentedness with you? Are you motivated to go out and be a part of the change? Are you feeling completely overwhelmed? And does that debilitate you? It manifests differently for every single individual.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to reach critical mass because the truth is we're in a window right now. You know, according to the IPCC, International Panel on Climate Change, we're in a window of about 10 to 12 years.
Yeah.
Where we still have an opportunity, should we take drastic measures to keep us below the, 2 degrees.
Yeah.
Number, right? Which is that magic number for anyone who follows any sort of climate science. That's just to keep it below.
We can't just sit back and expect the government or corporations to fix all our problems. Whatever we do, we have to put in our best effort. There are so many issues that need solving, and it's up to us as individuals to make a difference. So go out, plant some trees, see some of the natural wonders and beauties before they're gone. Turn it into an educational moment for your kids as you travel to teach them about climate change. Maybe look for activist groups or church groups that are already trying to make a difference. The point is, do what you can. Care. Sometimes small differences today can make a big impact for tomorrow. The Ecoverse podcast is dedicated to help spreading the word about the amazing work being done to save our planet. We hope to bring you many more episodes that are filled with inspiring stories from around the world that have a real impact on climate change for our future generations. The Ecoverse was produced by Creative Studio Productions, a production company dedicated to telling the stories of people making a difference for our planet in the world. If you have a story that you think would be good to share, go to www.cspmn.com and click on the contact page. We'll see you next time.